There's a thousand further women living out there. They're all living the devil may care. Well, I'm just a devil with a lot of despair. So
thank you, Wayne Newton, for that fabulous intro. You're listening to Cats with the Dish. I'm John Katzalamidis. I write the Cats Report in the Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly, and I contribute to all the titles in Greenspun Media Group, including Vegas Magazine. It has a story about our guest, part two of which is going to air this week, Oscar Goodman. Joining me is the ever-beautiful Trish McCrone. Trish?
Hey, you look very handsome today, Katz. Can I say that? Yes. I'm like, Katz, for, I know you guys can't see it, but Katz is wearing pink, and it's a very manly pink, but it's like he looks very fresh and handsome, and, you know, and I have to say that his shaved head that I shaved is growing in wonderfully. I mean, you know, what a lucky guy you are. Before we get into talking about, you know, our part two, but what a lucky guy you are that you are probably the only guy that I know that could shave their head, or have their head shaved, again.
You shaved it.
Yes. To have their head shaved, and literally, it even comes in thicker. Like, do you know how many men, like, struggle with baldness and struggle with all of
most.
This stuff? That you are, like, you're a freak of nature. Like, if I was a man, I would just hate you. It's kind of like those really skinny, incredibly beautiful people that, you know, women hate. Like, you have male envy.
We were down at Fox 5 yesterday. I do this segment on Fox 5 where we talk about some of the columns I've written. And they were saying that me and Jason Feinberg are the two guys that they have resentments against because of that very reason. Because I don't think Jason's ever shaved his head.
No. But
I don't think he ever would.
You put it to the test.
You know what? This was done for St. Baldrick's, you know, first of all. And so did they get a lot of mileage out of this deal.
Yeah.
And that's why I did it, is to raise awareness for St. Baldrick's to help fight childhood cancer. That was why we did it.
Yeah. I mean, in 2 months, your hair is pretty much back to normal.
I will tell, and you know, it's weird because I think, I don't know any, necessarily any woman personally who would readily do this.
Kelly Pickler did. That's probably the only person I can think of. No, she's on Dancing with the Stars in the finals. Her best friend was diagnosed with cancer.
Some do this.
And so she shaved her head in solidarity with her
friend. There was a Cirque performer who also did it the day we were there, too, who was in Zumanity over there at MGM Grand. I can't remember the woman's name, but she had taken it all the way down. But, you know, when you shave your head, it's a very interesting sensation, personally. But when you shave it down, you do realize where everything is on your head. Where your hairline goes, where all the calyx and weather patterns, all the swirls.
Patterns.
My head looked like, you know, I've got
a tsunami around.
I looked at it in a
ear.
Mirror and it looked like an aerial shot of Australia with like a tropical storm coming in. But I'll tell you, we'll do it again. But next year, we're going to raise a lot of money to do it. We're going to put a number up there. We're going
to
put a number high.
Yeah.
And they got to hit the number.
Yeah. No, it was, I'm very proud of you. It was a very selfless thing to do. And, you know, and luckily it all worked out.
Well, you had to do it. That was a condition. If you couldn't do it, I wasn't going to show up.
Oh, God. The pressure. But it looks, you know, it looks great. And luckily, everything worked out wonderfully and a lot of money was raised. But
yes.
We did something that we usually don't do. Last week was our interview.
What are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about on the show. Well, wait, again, what am I talking about?
True, on the show also.
So that we had on one of our favorite people in this town, former Mayor Oscar Goodman, talking about his book, Being Oscar. And we have never actually said, there was a time with Penn Jillette where you forgot.
I didn't notice.
Yeah, I kept like basically like putting like a, I practically like rented a plane with a message in front of you that says we're over, that, you know, you went a half an hour over on the interview.
We're in the dressing room there, the monkey room, they call it, Penn and Teller, and we started the interview and we're going along just fine. And apparently about 20 minutes in, Trish is poking me and I don't notice because I'm immersed in this conversation with Penn Jillette. And so we have 20 extra minutes somewhere
it's
in
still,
the ether.
Yeah, someday it'll be like in the like lost footage.
It'll be,
you know?
The director's cut.
What this goes is that, you know, Oscar Goodman, as everyone knows, is just a personality that is just larger than life.
Yes, he is.
And when he got talking about the book, as I'm those of you who listened last week, that if not, you can get it on Cats with the Dish. If you go there, you can download and listen to the episode if you missed it. But that he literally, the stories were so good. And before we knew it, we were done. Mm-hmm. And we both were like kind of, again, doing the hitting each other. And finally, you know, you typed it up like two-parter. I'm like, absolutely, because it was just too much incredible stuff to stop. And
totally
what we
agree.
We talked a lot about him, you know, his first cases of becoming a mob attorney and, you know, and Tony Spilotro and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But in this episode, it's very cool. We go into the movie Casino and those real life characters.
Right.
And his partner.
Someone who was not only in the movie, but knew these people personally. He's a fascinating man. And Oscar is a brilliant man in ways that I think people don't realize, because we see the iconic image, and it's on the cover of the book, of him with the martini and the two showgirls, and, you know, kind of a caricature. But I learned a lot. When I covered him in City Hall especially, Oscar reads a book a week.
Wow.
You know, people don't realize he reads and reads and reads. He's got a retentive memory that's incredible.
And he wrote this whole thing in longhand.
Yeah, he wrote the book in longhand, folks. You know, a lot of us have a tough time just writing a personal note.
Notes for my birthday or a month ago. I still don't have
it. It's an imposition for me just to sign my name at the bank. So, you know, this is a rare character. He's unique. He's uniquely brilliant and talented as a politician and a high-achieving attorney, and now he's got a book out that is a real fast read.
Yeah, and it's so funny. We don't really even talk very much about his time as being mayor, because that's so much that people know. It's more, you know, we literally could have done a three-parter. He's such a plethora of information.
So he is up next, but first it's Josh Bell with films, so stick around. I know we will.
Phil.
What, Alan?
Well, I was just going to say, I got this strange email the other day. I wasn't sure what it meant, but now I think it might be from Chow.
Fatty, it feels good to be out. I'm close by. Tell no one. I'll be in touch. Chow.
This says Chow.
How did you not know this was from Chow?
At the time, I thought it was Chow like goodbye. You know, like Chow, arrivederci, sabato, papa Chow.
I'm writing it back.
That's Bradley Cooper as Phil and Zach Galifianakis as Alan in The Hangover Part 3. I'm Josh Bell, film critic for Las Vegas Weekly, with a look at what's new in theaters this week. The creators of The Hangover Part 3 seem so stung by the accusations that The Hangover Part 2 was a carbon copy of the 2009 original that they've instead created a completely different kind of movie that may feature the same characters, but has gone from being a madcap, occasionally dark comedy, to a surprisingly intense thriller. There are no quotable lines here, just an unpleasant, mean-spirited story. What was once fresh and fun is now just obnoxious and worn out. I give The Hangover Part 3 1.5 stars out of 5. Also opening this week is Fast and Furious 6, the latest installment in the action series starring Vin Diesel as the head of a gang of car racing outlaws.
I'm gonna need everything. All the info you got.
You'll get it when the team gets it.
No team. This is gonna have to be me alone.
It's not that simple.
While the set pieces in Fast and Furious 6 that involve the crew taking down tanks, cargo jets, and experimental attack vehicles are marvels of stunt work and special effects, they're also completely divorced from reality, and the main characters might as well be superheroes for how invulnerable they've become. The movie gets bogged down in bonding moments between its cardboard characters, and it's also way, way too long. It even ends with a cliffhanger setting up the villain for the next movie. I give Fast and Furious 6 2.5 stars out of 5. That's a look at what's new in theaters this week. Check out my reviews in Las Vegas Weekly and online at joshbellhateseverything.com.
But you do say that you never would represent a rat.
I never represented a rat.
You represented a rat.
No.
You represented Colada.
I never represented Colada. No.
I mean,
no, Colada was represented by, he was represented by a lawyer who had his office on the floor above mine. And one day they're on their way to court, and Colada says, "How do I look?"
Yeah, the tie.
And I said, "Yeah, if you wore a tie, you'd show a little respect for the court." And he said, "Well, I don't know how to tie one." So I taught him how to tie one. I just wish I had tied it tighter.
Well, because he definitely was a rat who turned a lot on Spilotro.
Yes, and the reason for that was, in the old days, and I go, I'm an old-timer, I go back a long way, the mob used to take care of their own. If a guy got arrested, they would get him a lawyer, they would take care of his family. The newer mobsters, they were not as generous. And you got a guy like Colada sitting in jail. He doesn't have anybody paying for his lawyer. His family is not being taken care of the way he expected them to be taken care of. I'm just using him as an example. And then some FBI agent visits him and says, you know, we have information that Spilacho is going to put a hit on you. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I never saw any proof of that whatsoever. But yeah. Galata, sitting in there, he says, well, no one's taking care of me. Why should I not take care of myself? And then they flip. And they flip in a way, and it happens all the time. A fellow who admits 4 murders, and in Philadelphia, Philip Leonetti admitted 8 murders or 10 murders or something, they're given a pass, basically credit for time served. And they're put in a witness protection program, and they could be your next-door neighbor. And you would never know that because nobody ever tells you that. And as far as I'm concerned, a leopard doesn't change his spots. And the deals that the government makes with these guys are so unconscionable from my perspective that, first of all, I wouldn't want to participate in the dealing process there. And second of all, I don't like people who benefit as a result of that kind of, I consider it to be a terrible misconduct on the part of the United States government when they make a deal like that. They make a decision that it's more important for one of these guys to testify against somebody than to punish that person for the murders that person committed.
Right.
Wait, before we wrap up really quick,
I have to say,
out of everything in the book, this was my favorite quote, and it is, of all the decisions I've made in my life and of all of the things I've accomplished, nothing compares to marrying Carolyn.
And that's the truth, and I'll tell you something. If I didn't have Carolyn by my side, I probably would have been a consigliere.
My favorite fun fact in this book is that she knew how to count cards.
She does.
I didn't know that.
She was a counter before they had counters.
I want to play cards with her when she's termed out.
She's a counter. She's a counter who didn't know she was a counter.
That's a great.
I know we're going to run a little long, but we could probably use the story in another show. But what is very funny is kind of your way of kind of becoming the mob attorney was because of the fact that Carolyn used to play blackjack. And wasn't it a blackjack dealer that first represented you? If you could just
well,
tell
what happened, my dad sent us a wonderful wedding gift. We didn't have 2 cents. We got out here with $87 in our collective pockets.
Right.
And he sent us $25 a week to be spent solely on entertainment. We couldn't use it for rent. Mm-hmm. We couldn't use it for gasoline for the car. It had to be on entertainment. So every week I would take Carolyn out. She loved the Hacienda, which is now imploded.
Uh-huh.
I think Mandalay is there at that spot. Mm-hmm. And we would go to, I think it was called the charcoal room there, have a nice meal. And whatever money we had left over, she would sit down and play blackjack. And I would stand behind her because here I was a law clerk in the DA's office. And I said to myself, they don't build these beautiful places because people are beating them. And I said, I don't want to be looked at as a sucker. So I would stand behind her. And in those days, Vegas was different. The dealers were very, very cordial and friendly. You could talk to them while they're dealing. And I struck up a conversation. We became friends basically across the table. And one day this fella called me up and he said, Oscar, I have some financial problems. I'd like to file a bankruptcy. I said, sure, come on down. I had my office over a little flower shop in downtown Las Vegas. And it was very romantic. And we're sitting down at my little bridge table. As I said, I had 2 cents. And we filled out the bankruptcy petition. I charged him $250, which was a lot of money to me at that time. And he was happy. I was happy. And then a couple weeks later, a phone call came into the pit at the Hacienda. And the floor man, the pit boss, answers the phone. And the fellow on the other line says, my stepbrother, who I haven't seen in 20 years, got arrested in Las Vegas. I want the best criminal lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And he cups the phone and he says, who's the best criminal lawyer?
this is a great way to find legal counsel.
Instead of saying, I don't know, he says, who's the best criminal lawyer in Las Vegas? And the guy I did the bankruptcy for said, call Oscar. And that's the way it all started. And it just so happens that I got a phone call and a fellow on the other end said, come over to such and such an address and I got something for you. Scared to death. I said, Carol, will you take a ride with me?
Yeah, tough guy.
So we went over. I went to the door. The guy said, tomorrow morning you're going to get a phone call. But in the meantime, here are 3 dimes in an envelope. I had no idea what a dime was.
You're probably thinking 30 cents.
I didn't know what he was talking about.
When people drop dime, you don't know what that means.
Well, I know drop a dime, but he says, here's three dimes. So I go around the corner, we stop, and I open up the envelope. I see $3,100 bills. $3,000 more money than I ever saw at one time in my life. And I get a phone call the next morning. You better win this case. Well, it turns out that the brother who made the phone call was a mobster who had the pornography and bookmaking rackets in the Northeast and in Canada. And he expected me to win this case. And it was a case I could have tried 100 times, 1,000 times. I'd never win it. It was, all the government had to prove is a car was stolen and somebody was behind the wheel in another state from where it was stolen. And I represented this kid. And the case lasted one day. I was so nervous, I threw up on the courthouse steps. The mob museum, I hope they have a plaque there someday.
There was discussion of this.
This is where Oscar parked it. I was so nervous. And so we get through arguing to the jury. It was on Valentine's Day of 1968. And we start walking back to the office. And the client's brother, the mobster, says, is it better if it's a quick verdict or they take a long time? Oh, I said, oh, a long time. I had no idea what I was talking about. I said, a long time. The longer, the better. We get back to the office, 20-minute walk. The phone's ringing.
Uh-oh.
The jury has a verdict. Oh, my God, I wanted to die. And we walk back to court, and the verdict was not guilty. And from then on, whenever somebody had a problem and they asked this fellow and his friends who to call, I got the phone call from any place in the country, and I just got real lucky, and that's how the career started.
That's how your career as a mob attorney was launched,
That's how
right?
it started. It's not as though, as Sally Denton says in The Money and the Power, it's not as though the Philadelphia mob set me out here.
Well, I mean, all of this happened, and you became so synonymous with being the mob attorney, that in Casino, the movie
myself.
Casino, and when we've been talking about, for those people that don't know, that we've been talking of, which I don't think are many, but Spilotra was basically the Joe Pesci character in Casino,
right.
And Lefty Rosenthal was another one of your clients, was the Robert De Niro character,
exactly.
Who was married to
Sharon Stone.
Sharon Stone's character, she was Ginger, but her real name was
Jerry Rosenthal, right.
And so you then played yourself. So
I
how
did
that come about that you played yourself in Casino?
What happened was they were talking about who was going to play different roles. And Scorsese and Pileggi were talking. Pileggi wrote the book. Scorsese was the director. And they said, who should play the lawyer? So Rosenthal said, why don't you use my lawyer?
And where you filmed the restaurant scene is your restaurant now, right?
Yes.
That was center stage.
That was interesting.
At the time.
Yeah, we did it there. We did it at the Riviera. And they used my law office, actually.
Mm-hmm.
There was a scene there where we were talking about a divorce between the two of them, De Niro and Sharon Stone were there, and it was my law office that was the place where it really took place. And it was a great experience for me. And that's the reason I ran for mayor, to be honest with you, because I wasn't getting any other parts. My mother saw
the typecast.
Well, my mother saw the movie, and she said, I saw your movie. It's a good thing you're a lawyer. So
well, you went on to play yourself in CSI.
Well, what I did was this. I said, anyone making a movie in Las Vegas when I'm the mayor has to give me a part if they get a permit.
I just watched the movie again. It's one of my favorite movies. I just watched it again last weekend, as a matter of fact, it was on. And I love how Sharon Stone keeps saying, call Oscar. Like, that was like the first thing that came to her mind. But now I'm curious, because you did know these people well, and you mentioned in an earlier story about Joe Pesci's character of Spilotra, that it didn't really inhabit who the man really was. It was that he was a much nicer man.
I thought he was
yeah.
Yes.
Now, I want to know some things that were maybe accurate or not accurate from the movie. As a huge fan.
Well, I was with Tony Spilotra. The only person I was with more than Tony Spilotra during those years was my wife.
Wow.
I mean, I was representing him on murder mm-hmm. cases, racketeering cases, all RICO cases, all kinds of cases, all over the place. And I never saw the man using cocaine. I never saw him give a racial expression which was derogatory, as they portrayed it in the movie. So I was a little offended, to be honest with you, and I thought that was not accurate. Now, it's interesting, in real life, and everything in the book is true, at least according to the truth, according to Oscar, the way I perceive things. Here I am in two separate instances. I'm representing members of crime families that are at odds with each other, and I didn't even know they were members of crime families. I mean, it's extraordinary. I represented somebody from the Lucchese crime family, and I represented somebody from the Gambino crime family. They hated each other, but I'm their lawyer, and I'm just representing them on the case.
You're just too immersed in the case?
I had no idea that there were crime families, other than hearing the government talk about it. I didn't believe the government. And the other one was, when I found out, and basically I found this out by watching the movie Casino, that Spilotra supposedly had a relationship with Jerry Rosenthal, I fell off my seat. I said, that's impossible. Here I am, I'm representing Tony, I'm representing Frank, I'm a friend of Jerry Rosenthal's. Our kids went to the same schools, they played Little League together. The girls were friendly. I could not believe it. So had I known what I know now, I would have charged a lot more. and I would have in my own private plane. That I promise you.
But, and also, in the film, it alludes to the fact that I'll just use the characters in the movie, so I'm not pinning on anything on anybody, that Joe Pesci's character in the movie was the person that set up the big explosion in front of Tony Roma's. That's
the impression you certainly got.
Yeah, from the movie. Absolutely. Was there any fact to that?
No, I got a phone call from Frank Rosenthal that he had just been blown up. He was on a gurney. Would I come over right away? And I went from my home. I live in the Rancho Charleston area and drove over to Tony Roma's on the East Sahara. And he's out there. And he says, I'll make him pay. Not my business to ask who. I mean, I was a need to know lawyer. I wanted to know what I had to know to win a case. I didn't want to get involved in their personal lives. And he never told me that he thought it was Tony. Never said that at all. Tony never even hinted that he had any malice towards Rosenthal. That's why I was so surprised when I saw the relationships develop in the movie.
I want to ask something about Carolyn. And your early years in Las Vegas that a lot of things about her I didn't know that are in the book. One was that she worked at the Riviera in advertising.
That was her first
publicity.
First job.
And you make a slight reference to her taking you out to events, which is sort of a wag the dog situation if you get to know how your career unfolded as mayor.
Well, she did pretty good herself.
Yeah, right. It sounds like that she was the first one to kind of be the
breadwinner.
Right. And not only the breadwinner, but to introduce you into that type of networking world.
Well, in a sense, but if you'll remember in the book, I also say after she left the job at the Riviera, where we had seen every show in town, the only one I liked was the Wayne Newton show.
Very smart man. I agree.
I was showed out, actually. I never wanted to see another show after going with it. She dragged me around, and then she went to work at Caesar's Palace as the executive secretary for the three partners who founded it.
Right.
And one of them said to her, what do you need this guy for? She said, he pointed to me across the room, what do you need him for? He scrambled eggs when you could have roast beef. Well, he was a little twerp, the guy.
There you go.
There's a word that you use in place of twerp, but it's a great line.
Right, well, he's a little twerp.
But it was also throughout all this time, I love the relationship with Carolyn that you have in the book. That, I mean, in your life, obviously, it's trying. But it was very much that there's so much that, yes, she was at home with the children and she was supporting, but she really was the force that kept you in line. There was a time when one of the first times, I don't remember who it was, one of your more nefarious type of clients had an event at the Fountain Blue, and it was all this money was being spent on and you said, yeah. Oh, I would love to do this for our children. Yes. And she said something about not wanting you.
Don't become your client, she said.
Exactly.
And what she was saying really was, your clients want you to be a cut above them. Sometimes they don't like themselves because they're doing what perhaps they're being charged with or looked at with askance by the public. They want you to be respected. They want judges to find you to be credible. You're their mouthpiece, basically. And if you have credibility with the court, you're going to do them a lot better job than if a judge thinks that you're one of them. And that's what she meant. And it was a great lesson because I saw so many lawyers over the years become shysters.
Well, yeah, I would think it would be very intoxicating around
all. Look,
here
I was a young kid. I wasn't 25 years old when I started to represent these folks. And they were characters. It was like a Damon Runyon story. I mean, a little fella, Bobby Kay, was a little person. I tell the story, they used to call him the midget because he was a midget. Being politically correct, I refer to him as a little person in the book. But I represented him. This is one of the great lines of all time, if you follow criminal law at all. Instead of taking the fifth, he went into the grand jury and he didn't come out, even though I told him to come out after every question to talk to me. He's in the grand jury for a half an hour answering their questions. And I said, Bobby, when he came out, what did you do here? He says, don't worry. I said, what did you do in there? He said, I took the 2.5.
oh my
ouch.
God.
But I mean, it was those kind of things. There was a fellow with a little arm. They called him Wingy.
Oh.
I don't know whether you remember, you didn't live here at that time. There was a great Italian pizzeria at the end of the strip called the Tower of Pisa. It was the Leaning Tower of Pizza. And the fellow who owned it was Jasper Special. And he was always a subject of law enforcement interest. And he had a partner who had a hunchback. and they called him the camel. I mean, as I say, it was like living a story.
Oh, sure.
And here I am, a young kid, and these fellas, everything was green in those days in Las Vegas. Everything was cash. The IRS wasn't after these the dealers as they came in later years to look at every cent that was being made. And everybody had money. That's why people came to Las Vegas. It was awash with cash. Mm-hmm. And everybody did well. And I didn't have any money. I was a clerk, and then I was a young lawyer, public defender, and didn't have 2 cents to speak of. So it was intoxicating, no question about it. But when you have somebody like Carolyn as a policewoman looking over your shoulder and keeping you straight, thank goodness it happened that way, because I know plenty of lawyers who had problems over the years.
What do you think it was about you? I mean, I know obviously you're very brilliant, very well-spoken, and you got them off. Literally, you got them off. So, but why do you think that you became so trusted that you were the guy? What is it about you that differentiated you from other
attorneys? Because I never lied to anybody. I know that sounds arrogant. I don't mean it that way. I would tell them the truth. I have my oldest boy's a doctor. He's an oncologist. And say to him, I said, man, I said, do you tell your patients news with rose-colored glasses, or do you tell them the truth? And he says, I learned from you, Dad. You tell them the truth. No matter how hard the truth is to take, you tell them the truth, and then you confront the problem by telling the truth. I told my clients the truth. I told them if they had a problem. I told them what they were looking at. One of the phenomena of the practice was I would tell a client. In those days, they did not remand a person after a jury came back and found him guilty. They let him stay out pending sentencing. And I told one client, I said, you're going to get 20 years. 20 years is a long time. And I figured that he's going to, you know, get on his high horse. He had plenty of money and go down to Punta Cana or someplace like that, or at least do some research as to where there wasn't any extradition. Yeah. Come sentencing day, he comes waltzing into court. Judge gave him 20 years, and they took him away. And he just figured he was a man. That was the game was played. He took his best shot and didn't complain. As I said, did not complain. I don't think they're that way anymore. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with OJ, whether he's going to get himself a new trial or not. But, of course, the first thing you do these days is to complain that your lawyer didn't do a good job. I never had that happen to me. Ever.
Yeah, it's tough spot for the attorney to be in this
environment. Tough spot, but, yeah. You know, if the allegations are correct with the OJ thing, then let the chips fall where they may.
My last question for you, it's possible, entirely possible, that Being Oscar is going to be adapted to a film at some point.
I don't know. I have not been given that assurance.
Let's say that it goes in that direction. Yes. Have you thought about who plays you in this movie?
Absolutely. I think about it every single waking moment
of my
life.
And who is it?
The handsomest actor of that time. Whoever is the handsomest actor, they will play me. Whoever the handsomest is.
All right. That narrows it down. All right, Oscar Goodman, we have got to close it up.
Okay, I had a good time here. I could talk forever.
Oh, yeah. We absolutely love hearing. I've been so excited. Out of all the interviews we've done, I have to say I've been most excited about this.
I had a good time.
Because not only an incredible man, you're incredible to the city of Las Vegas.
And I look at the two of you as being real assets to our community. We've known each other a long time,
yes.
And you've always been the best. And John and myself, we're friends, and it's been a good ride.
It has been. Absolutely.
It's just the beginning. A whole new thing.
Absolute for real a Las Vegas icon, Oscar Goodman. The book is called Being Oscar. George Anastasia taking the rudder and telling this story with Oscar Goodman. It's a great read, man. It is a great read. And we thank the former mayor and current friend for coming down to see us.
Thank you, my friend.